Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for attending this event tonight. We're all in for a great treat. As far as praise for David Olley's books goes, it's certainly not hard to find nice things in incredibly high places. Ben Marcus, well-respected writer and director of Columbia's MFA program, in fact, needed an entire introduction. No mere blurb would do to contain his breathless celebration of Olley's first novel, Motorman. Ben Marcus writes, "To read Motorman now is to encounter proof that a book can be both emotional and eccentric, smeared with humanity and artistically ambitious, messy with grief, and dazzling with spectacle." Brian Evanson, another fine writer, has said this of Olley's second novel, The Age of Sinatra, "A beautifully strange novel, imbued with nervous laughter and serious social critique, The Age of Sinatra is a startling book, excessive in all the right ways." And then, of course, there are the things my friends and I say. We really can't stop ourselves from speaking about David Olley. One friend of mine, a friend who gives only Motormans for birthday and wedding presents, once said something about Olley's name. He said, "Sure, his name simply rhymes with holy, but doesn't he have something to be revered, something to be in awe of within him, too?" So who knows what sputtered things I'll say to my friends after tonight. Please join me in welcoming David Olley.
Thank you very much. I think the first thing that I'd like to read to you is something I didn't write, but I did edit. And it's from a book called Cows Are Freaky When They Look at You, which is a collection of oral tales from the 60s and early 70s in Lawrence. And this is actually the first little tale in the book. Can I find it? It's called Slow Motion. We dropped acid in the Flint Hills near Emporia. Driving home along Highway 50, a debate ensued as to whether the car was moving. We decided that if indeed we were stopped, a cop was sure to come along and question us. But we couldn't pull onto the shoulder because we might be moving, and in Kansas, it's against the law to drive on the shoulder. What can we do? What are we doing? Those were the two questions acid-loaded groups were always asking themselves. For the longest time, no one was able to convince a majority either that we were moving or that we were stopped. There was always a swing vote that never really knew. So I came up with a test. I opened the door and lightly dangled my foot out. I was going to see what would happen when it hit the pavement. Some people looked out, saw the white stripes whizzing by, and said, "No, no, man, don't put your foot out there. Look how fast we're moving." "No," I said, "it's not moving at all." "Yes, it is," they said. "But it seems the car should be rocking if we're moving." "But it is," they said. "Can't you feel it?" "Yeah, fuck, it is rocking." "Turn on the windshield wipers and see what happens." "Is it raining?" "No." There's 110 of those stripes to the mile, I know that. "Let's time it and see how fast we're going." I stepped out onto the pavement. With the door open, I looked back at the driver. "Well," he said, "are we moving or aren't we?" I'm going to read now a few sections from a novel that was co-authored. My co-author is an old friend of mine, and there's quite a story behind it. We grew up together in New Orleans all the way up through high school when he went off to the seminary and was later kicked out for heresy. Then we went to Louisiana State together, and we were good friends most of our lives. Our parents knew one another and so on. And after graduating from LSU, he came to KU studied entomology and got his PhD here in entomology, and had a very strong urge to leave the country for a variety of reasons, and ended up in South Africa, in Johannesburg, at the University of the Witwatersrand, where he taught for years. And I had been out of touch with him for 36 years, all total. I had not heard a word from him. I knew he was in South Africa. I'd sent him a couple of emails after I tracked him down and got no response whatsoever. And then all of a sudden, about a year ago, I got an email from him. And just right out of the blue, as if 36 years hadn't gone by at all, let's do some writing together, he said. And he began to send me every week or so a couple of pages of his writing. And I was to somehow match it, like 50-50. He would send me two pages. I would write two pages of my own that kind of went along with what he was writing. And I would edit his writing fairly heavily because it was very scientifically oriented. What he does now, incidentally, is he travels around China, Borneo, Bangkok, places like that, consulting people about raising bees. He's a bee expert now. And so he sent me these pieces of his writing, and the whole thing lasted about 5 or 6 months, and then he stopped writing altogether. He said, that's it, I've run out of words, that's all I'm going to do. And so I, at that point, we had about 100 pages done, so I cut it off at that point. So what I'm going to read to you represents partially his writing, partially mine. I mean, I edited what he sent me heavily. I added my own, and I tried to develop a theme, although a lot of what he sent me was very loose and disorganized. I tried my best to get a theme going with it. The title of the book is The Duck Ladies. The young professor drew endless pictures of planes fighting in the skies, which he posted to his father, who was far away on a ship at war. But his first encounter with him in the flesh occurred one morning in 1945, when rounding a corner on his tricycle, he saw a very peculiar man in a white uniform with a beard doing something to his mother. In retrospect, it must have been a long-awaited embrace of return. In that period, the professor lived in a world of three blocks, his own home being situated just around the corner from Our Lady of the Rosary. Opposite lived his uncle, a general practitioner who was more often paid in kind rather than cash. Poulet d'eau, squirrels, raccoons, hampers of blue crabs, mudfish, and oranges. There was an endless flow of ducks in season and out, and a sack of eels at Christmas. Our Lady's church was insufferably hot, humid, and unbearable. The little paper fans simply shifted one bolus of hot air to the left and then to the right. It was normal Sunday torture for small boys who could not see over their elders and who were told not to fidget or create an unforgivable scene. At the corner of Bayou Road and Mystery Street was the blacksmith, doing what smiths do all day. This too was a source of endless fascination for the young professor, watching the red-faced smith clanging and banging metals into articles of use. The boy was too young to understand what the articles were, and it mattered not. The excitement was the fire and the smoke and clanging, wind chimes to the ears of a small boy. And there were other excitements, as when a neighboring dairyman taught him to pull on dugs and squirt the warm ooze into galvanized tubs. Catty-corner to the young professor's own house was the funeral home, which, while he was not allowed to consort with the dead, he was allowed to climb into the caskets, provided his feet were clean. It gave him a smooth and cool sensation on the skin, not unlike waking on a hot summer's morning under a sweat-drenched bedsheet. He could lull in that cool silk pillow until the rising sun edged up to the funeral home's window. When the professor was mid-youth, he went with his father to shop on Sunday mornings. First stop, the chicken shop. For boys who had done nothing grander than crucify chameleons, it was horribly exciting. First there was the killing. The chicken's head on a block, and with a swift knife pass, the head dropped into a basket to be sold as crab bait. Then it was bled a bit and scalded to loosen the feather fascicules. Real excitement followed at the plucking drum, a round, rotating steel barrel with many rubber fingers lining the inside. As the drum spun and the chickens whirled around, the force of the rubber fingers jiggled the feathers off. There was a mansion in the professor's neighborhood that came to be called Mufat's Castle. It was modeled on the Kronberg Castle at Elsinore, where Hamlet's ghost is said to walk the parapets, and had 14-foot ceilings on the first and second floor, a grand staircase, 12-foot oak pocket doors, and more. The professor lived with his family across Grand Route St. John, in a house that once was to be the castle's servants' home. There were several tunnels under the house that were rumored to lead to the castle but had been blocked off and flooded. The family that built the castle and lived in it only a few years sold it to the wealthy Mufats in a vandalized and rundown condition. Prior to the scheduled renovations and before the family moved in, the professor entered the castle and found the place infested with do-nothings and vandals, busy smashing the contents. There was a grand piano thrown down one of the staircases and Delft tilework torn off the walls and crushed underfoot. Jacob Mufat, a wealthy brewer, his wife, Mildred, an inventor, and their two children moved in shortly after renovations were complete. Their son, Fiamese, born without cartilage in his legs and quite sickly, lived since childhood in a small cottage at the edge of the woodlot built to look like a smaller version of the castle. Servants brought him meals and took him to Our Lady's, where he and the professor became pals and spent a good bit of time together in the summers. Because Fiamese was confined to a wheelchair, the professor read to him for hours every day. There was always something of interest in the castle's vast library. Sea tales were a particular favorite of Fiamese. As soon as the professor had read the last lines of Moby Dick, Moby Dick's epilogue, Fiamese would say, "Start over, start over." When winter came, Jacob and Mildred decamped for better climes, leaving Fiamese behind. He wouldn't see them for months. Their daughter, whose name the professor never learned, was an invalid, probably a victim of infantile paralysis. The only glimpse he ever had of her was when he was perched on the castle wall one day eating a tongue sandwich. He happened to be looking at an indigo bunting swooping past the third-story window when the curtains suddenly opened and he saw her lying in an iron lung. She must have been about 12 or 13. She turned her head toward the sun and struggled to smile. The poor thing died before she was 20, the professor learned. Later, at university, the 20-something professor was struck by a car while riding his bicycle. An accident that buggered his left leg, tearing away a good bit of calf muscle. Though only half conscious on the way to the hospital, his sense of smell became heightened. The odor rising from his flayed open muscle was much the same as the scent of flesh and blood he remembered from the chicken shop. 35 years later, little fissures continue to open up on the scar face and suppurate for months. They scabbed, stank, sloughed, and repeated the cycle relentlessly. The professor was in Kuching, an administrative capital on the island of Borneo, where it rained, he liked to say, every yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Not ordinary rain, either, but of a cast yellow as bile and warm as it struck the skin. Sitting in the Catstown bar, drinking sambuca and plum juice, with the sounds of rattling knives and screaming Muslims outside, the professor said to the bartender, "Listen to that. It sounds like a fantasia written by Gorecki as a fourth movement." The bartender seemed not to understand. "Who, sir? The Greek? The Spaniard? The painter they called El Greco?" "No, no," the professor said. "Gorecki. The Polish composer they called Heinrich Mikołaj Gorecki." "You want a drink, professor, sir?" "Yes. What have you got that's strong?" "Very strong. I have a painful procedure to do, and you best not look." "I'll give you some God's milk. You will like it. It's not milk, but something else, extra strong." "If you say so, mate." After a decade of buying rotten red wine at outrageous prices in Asia, the professor was looking for a change. The pink, milky drink was very tasty, bitingly alcoholic, and had a hint of pomegranate in it. "Excellent," the professor said. "Why is it called God's milk?" "The Hindu gods like to drink it, especially Lord Ganesha." "Give me the whole bottle, then." After throwing down a dozen jiggers of the liquor, the professor probed around his never-ending leg wound with a pair of jeweler's forceps until he felt a sliver of bone fragment about 2 centimeters long. "I got it," he yelped. The bartender, thinking the professor was having a heart attack, rushed to him. "There it is," the professor said, "a first-class relic. I must be careful, though. I do not want to compete with St. Teresa of Avila, who has spread piecemeal all over fucking Europe." His cackling laughter vibrated the bottle of God's milk so much it scuttled several inches over the damp tablecloth. "I have never seen a thing like that," the bartender said, returning to the bar. "Bit of a mishap at the university," the professor said. "Hit by a car. They found my calf on the bumper a day and a half later." "The wound's been producing these relics all along. I keep them in a little vials in my medicine cabinet. Someday I'll build a proper reliquary." The bartender shook his head and picked up a telephone receiver. "Who are you calling?" the professor asked. "I hope not the Pope." The cackling again moved the bottle to the very edge before the professor caught it. "A taxi for you, sir. It's almost time to close." Tiring of the rain, the professor cut short his stay in Kuching and went over to Long Sumatra in Sarawak, Borneo to hunt bees and to visit Yaya, a retired headman, accomplished at book learning, and an old friend. To get to Yaya's longhouse, the professor flew to Lawas, the sin capital of northern Borneo, where he stayed the night in a rundown motel with dozens of flying roaches in the room. In the morning, he went to the duty-free store and bought God's milk smuggled in from the nearest anchorage at Labuan. Then it was 5 hours in a limber pedal lorry up mountains of mud. Pure, sentimental mud, not one rock, stone, or boulder. Then it rained, and he waited 3 days for the road to dry off enough to move again. And when he ran short of God's milk, his only recourse was the truly foul arak, which they claim is made of rice and molasses. The professor slept in Yahya's longhouse that first night and awoke mid-morning in a sweat. He saw Yahya sitting on the stoop gnawing a small human tibia. "Friends brought me this from Sampit," Yahya said. "There was a massacre. A day-old infant was left under an oil palm in the broiling sun. My friends stood around and waited until it died." "Yahya, what does human flesh taste like? It's always been a curiosity of mine." "Well," Yahya went on, "the taste of people meat varies. It has a nice and distinctive aroma as it cooks. But the taste depends on the lifestyle of the donor and whether they drank alcohol or preferred sweets or salty things. There is a basis for intrinsic taste which is amplified by lifestyle. Cooking matters too. There is a huge difference if you cook people meat in an electric kettle or a hot plate. A slow roast is the best." "That may be, my friend," the professor said. "But whether you're eating flesh for spiritual reasons and or to sate your hunger, I can promise you that even if it came from a stew with carrots and onions, we can still detect the myoglobin in your pots and your feces. You could easily be brought in on government charges." "My dear professor, what you see in my face is a mental victory, the thumping of human defeat that comes from eating human flesh. You'll never understand." "Perhaps not," the professor said. One of the professor's earliest patients, known to him as Ruthie the Duck Lady, was originally born in Vilno, Lithuania, but later came to his clinic for diagnosis and treatment. She took a fancy to eating the algae from the pond behind the laboratory building and watching the goldfish swim about. But in winter, when the pond looked like a sheet of glass, the goldfish schooled on the murky bottom. Tapping on the ice, as Ruthie did, stirred them little week after week, until the spring thaw. Many of them had died of the cold, leaving what looked to Ruthie like little black holes in the water. When the weather changed season to season, arthritis inflamed the professor's lumbar region, forcing him to spend more time than usual compiling his notes and observations. Typically, they had to do with his duck lady. One. An incipient but not visible beak, yellow-orange in color, lying among labial folds between and below the nares. On a few occasions, when enraged, she has everted the beak to inflict bites on my hands. Two, she overuses fricatives when speaking. Three, complains effusively when her radio fails to work and will wear nothing but a wedding dress at all times. Four, she's eaten all the acorns in the oak grove but every snail in the garden. Five, the entire clinic staff has gone to Kuching to celebrate Coward's Day, leaving me alone with Ruthie, who can be quite good company when she's taken a glass or two of God's milk. She has been reading Hume's Enquiries Concerning Human Understanding, having finished Burke's treatise on the sublime and the beautiful, which was badly chewed on when returned. About a year ago, Ruthie began releasing specific body parts when these parts were grasped, a form of autotomy. The first time it happened, she was standing on an overturned bucket as the professor trimmed her nails with a freshly sharpened paring knife. One of her feet was firmly in his grasp when a fit of quacking threw her off balance, and she fell backwards. When she did, the foot snapped off in the professor's hand. It was a ghastly and shocking sight at first. Yet there was no bleeding and no cry of pain from Ruthie. She righted herself and quite calmly replaced the bone in its socket as if it were a snap toy, and all was right again. She took a few steps this way, then that, and climbed back onto the bucket.
"All better,"
she quacked. Only a day or two later, the professor caught her stealing lard from the laboratory icebox and chased her past the house, around the pond, and finally to the edge of the woodlot, where when she turned to see where he was, he reached out and took hold of her scruff, which shed its flesh into his hand, and she kept on running. All of this led the professor to a bit of reading about autotomy in the archives of the proceedings. In lizards, he discovered it's the tail that autotomizes, not the digits or the limbs. In a few species, portions of skin autotomize, a defense strategy known as fragile skin. In the terrestrial plethodontid salamanders, tails, digits, and portions of their limbs are sacrificed as a means of escaping predators. Grasp a cricket by the leg and watch it break that limb away with a snap. The sea cucumber will fling its innards at a threatening drumfish to disorient it, then sidle into hiding and grow new ones. Like lizards who have evolved tail autotomy as an escape strategy, the professor's duck lady displayed movements of her bottom that were intended to attract his attention away from her more vulnerable top parts. The downy pin feathers there showed sharply contrasting colors and patterns. At the same time, the professor noticed a stereotypic twitching back and forth as she positioned herself for a run in the event he attempted to mount her. But the escape maneuver would be costly, representing a loss of fat and protein, which is needed for regrowth of the pudenda. During this time, she would remain at higher risk for his predations, as there would be little or nothing else for her to drop. And her reproductive life would go into hiatus, with gamete production completely halted. The professor theorized that autotomy in duck lady bottoms is enabled by special zones of weakness at regular intervals in the vertebra below the vent. Essentially, she contracts a muscle to fracture the vertebra itself rather than break the tail between the two vertebra. Sphincter muscles then contract around the caudal artery to stanch bleeding. While autotomy was rare in mammals, the professor knew, it did occur in mice, rats, and certain other rodents who could slough off the sheath of skin and fur covering their tails. He found this out one day when he was swing-bonking a rat against his laboratory wall to kill it. Suddenly, its weight was gone. He heard its thump against the wall and then strike the terrazzo floor. There he stood with a limp brown tail sheath in his hand, watching the rat disappear behind the autoclave. Consulting the proceedings in regard to honeybees and autotomy, he found that the stinger tears cleanly away from its body, though the sting shaft keeps moving to embed itself deeper. and the venom sac continues pumping for several minutes. The sting of a queen honeybee has no barbs and does not autotomize, while the genitalia of male drones do autotomize during copulation and form a mating plug, which is removed by subsequent drones that mate with the same queen and die in the process. Crabs, brittle stars, lobsters, and spiders can also lose and regenerate appendages. Autotomy also occurs in some kinds of octopus. A specialized reproductive arm, the hectocotylus, detaches from the male during mating and remains within the female's mantle cavity. More drastic self-preservation strategies were also noted in the proceedings. A California man amputated his leg below the knee with a chainsaw when it became stuck beneath a tree he'd felled. In Utah, a hiker's forearm was hopelessly crushed beneath a boulder. To get free, he severed it through the elbow with a pocket knife, then broke and tore the two bones apart. An Australian coal miner amputated his own arm with a Stanley knife when he found it trapped beneath his front end loader when it overturned deep within a coal mine. A New England crab fisherman got his arm caught in the winch during a storm and amputated it at the shoulder with a small axe. There were even rarer cases when self-amputation had been performed for other purposes. In Florida, a bizarre scam was uncovered involving individuals who cut off their own limbs to collect insurance money. A deranged Jesuit in New Orleans cut off his hand with an electric saw and videotaped the process to, quote, send a message to the FBI and the media. Evidence suggests the priest was a victim of body integrity identity disorder, a mental state in which one acts out a compulsion to remove body parts, usually a limb, but sometimes ears, eyes, tongues, even such internal organs as the appendix and the spleen. Given these facts, the professor took the precaution to store any and all sharpened objects in his laboratory safe, even kitchen knives from the house. It was one thing for Ruthie to exhibit simple autotomy for the purpose of escaping danger, but quite another if she embarked on a mental trail leading to self-amputation. Nevertheless, his fears were heightened one recent AM when he found her in his study quite involved in speed reading the proceedings. Being the suggestible creature that she was, knowledge could be a dangerous thing. It was the professor's fondest hope and expectation that his duck lady would be spared any further development along these evolutionary lines, and that she would continue in health and safety until the end of her days. That's all.
Thank you.